Thanks for tuning in for the January 14th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview showcases a study on Hashimoto encephalopathy in the 21st century. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear an interview on migraine progression in subgroups of migraine based on comorbidities. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online on the same webpage. It's easy and free for AAN members.
This is Stacey Clardy from the Salt Lake City VA and the University of Utah. Today, I'm talking with Drs. Josep Dalmau and Frances Graus from the Hospital Clinic of Barcelona, Spain, where they collaborate in running the neuroimmunology lab within the IDI-BAPS Biomedical Research Institute. They are world leaders in autoimmune encephalitis, discovering many new autoantibodies and also researching their pathogenesis. Josep is also known to many of us as the current editor of the Spoke journal, Neurology, Neuroimmunology, and Neuroinflammation. Over the years, their work has been featured in many of our podcasts. You can go look them up on the webpage searching by their last names. But today, we are actually not going to describe a new autoantibody for a change. Instead, we're going to discuss their recent paper in the journal Neurology, the January 14th issue, titled Hashimoto Encephalopathy in the 21st Century. Welcome, Josep and Frances, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Before I ask you detailed questions about your paper, we should acknowledge that Hashimoto's encephalopathy, also called at times steroid-responsive encephalopathy associated with autoimmune thyroiditis, or SRET for short, has really been controversial since the outset. And more recently, a major issue confusing understanding of Hashimoto's encephalopathy is that many of the reported cases appeared before the expanding spectrum of autoimmune antibodies and encephalitides were recognized or could even be tested. So tell me, Josep, should we, in 2019, still be using the term Hashimoto's encephalopathy, or is it a potentially misleading eponym in this modern era? You suggested in your paper that the findings point out the need for a redefinition of HE, as you call it for short. So should it be a redefinition? Should it be a renaming entirely? And by that, I mean, should we perhaps call it, you know, probable autoimmune encephalitis, antibody unknown, or something similar?
Well, the answer to if we should keep the term Hashimoto encephalopathy is yes. And I think that there are three reasons for this. First is that there is no other good term to replace this one. In practice, the term steroid-responsive encephalopathy associated with autoimmune thyroiditis is not equivalent. And most patients of our study, for example, did not have any evidence of thyroid dysfunction. Then the term probable autoimmune encephalitis, antibody negative, is also inappropriate because a substantial number of patients do not have focal deficits or pleocytosis in the spinal fluid or MRI findings suggesting inflammation, which are part of the criteria of probable autoimmune encephalitis antibody negative. So this is one reason. The second reason is that the important issue is not the term or the eponym use, but is knowing what it means. So many physicians consider Hashimoto encephalopathy any type of encephalopathy, that means any type of CNS symptom that occurs with elevated TPO antibodies and that respond to steroids. Then in practice, many patients remain with this diagnosis even if they don't respond to the steroids. If one uses this criteria, then many patients, we believe, are misdiagnosed. The concept should be updated to the current state of knowledge in neurology, which shows that in the diagnosis of Hashimoto encephalopathy, the excluding criteria are as important or more than the including criteria. In the current study, we use the criteria of Castillo and colleagues from Mayo Clinic, mildly modified. These criteria are the following. First, the subacute onset of cognitive impairment, psychiatric symptoms, or seizures. Second, normal thyroid function or mild clinical or subclinical hypothyroidism. Third, elevated serum titers of TPO antibodies. In our study, we use 200 international units per milliliter, which is much higher of what commercial or clinical labs use. Fourth, the absence of neuronal antibodies in serum and CSF. This is very important. And five, no evidence of infectious, toxic, metabolic, vascular, or tumoral causes that could explain the symptoms. And final, the third reason to keep the name of Hashimoto encephalopathy is that if we follow the criteria that I already mentioned, then we find patients who respond to steroids and others with identical clinical and paraclinical features who do not respond to steroids. Therefore, I come with two possible terms. One is updated Hashimoto encephalopathy criteria. And the second is steroid unresponsive Hashimoto-like encephalopathy. These are probably cover the disorders that for many years have been included within the term of Hashimoto encephalopathy. What is clear is that TPO or thyroid dysfunction should not be included as part of the name of the disease because, as we show in the paper, a substantial number of patients and controls have these antibodies.
So if I'm understanding, really the important part is don't jump to this diagnosis without ruling out other autoantibodies, you know, by neuronal staining or other methods. Is that fair?
I agree completely. The criteria of excluding any potential alternative diagnosis in this particular situation is very important because the Hashimoto encephalopathy is not defined in positive. I mean, we don't have clear clinical symptoms highly suggestive of this entity. We don't have any clear sign in the MRI to suggest the Hashimoto encephalopathy. So for this reason, to rule out any other possible autoimmune or not autoimmune disorder and make sure that no other antibodies, if we are thinking about the possibility of an autoimmune disease, are present, it's clearly very, very important.
And I guess in your paper, you're showing that really the TPO, which some people hang their hat on, we really shouldn't be doing it with a TPO antibody either.
The thyroid peroxidase or TPO antibodies are not good biomarkers. Then, to make the matter worse, sometimes neurologists make a very liberal use of the criteria and consider the diagnosis even in patients who do not have encephalopathy, that they have only, for example, isolated cerebellar ataxia or atypical psychosis, and they base the diagnosis on the presence of a positive TPO result, and obviously the absence of an alternative explanation. And obviously, when you are confronting a neurological disorder without a distinctive clinical symptoms, no evidence of inflammation in the CSF, no evidence of typical neuroimaging findings, and no biomarkers, you have to recognize that you are walking on thin ice, and the risk of misdiagnosis is high.
That's a great point. And Josep, let's dive into this a little deeper. So while we're sort of dissecting and making a case for maybe why the thyroid antibodies aren't a reliable biomarker, what do we know about the pathogenicity of these thyroid antibodies? And I guess first we should say there are four commonly checked thyroid antibodies over in the endocrinology clinic. And the Hashimoto encephalopathy historically generally only looked at two. They would look at TPO, thyroid peroxidase, and thyroglobulin. But there's two other thyroid antibodies as well, more associated classically with Graves. There are thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulins, or TSI for short, and then also thyroid-stimulating hormone receptor antibodies, TRAb for short. So my question for you is, are any of them pathogenic? What do we know about these antibodies really at all?
Well, this probably will be a very short answer to your question. To my knowledge, there is no evidence that any of these antibodies bind to neurons or directly cause neuronal dysfunction. You don't see any type of binding of these antibodies to the tissue or to the neurons. So this is very different from any type of antibody-associated disease, either paraneoplastic or the autoimmune encephalitis, in that you always see different types of binding or different patterns. But in here, no. And here you don't see absolutely anything. You don't see any reactivity. So to find out if any of these antibodies have any pathogenic effect on the nervous tissue, I would expect to see at least some type of binding. And then there is an important clinical reason that goes against a direct pathogenic effects of the thyroid antibodies, is that when patients with Hashimoto encephalopathy respond to steroids, which is in our series and in other series is about 30%, so 70% have similar types of symptoms and, if you like, criteria, but they don't respond to steroids, But the ones that respond to steroids usually show a clinical improvement that is faster, sometimes much faster, than that seen in any type of antibody-mediated disease. So all these findings let us believe that other inflammatory factors, probably antibody-independent, are involved in Hashimoto encephalopathy. But we don't have any other evidence, or I don't have any other answer to your question.
That's really an important answer. Can I ask you a follow-up question? Often clinically, what we see is patients come in with this marker. You know, they know they have a problem, and maybe it's loosely falling into the criteria as currently defined of Hashimoto's encephalopathy. And they come in and they say, look, my TPO antibody is really through the roof, and maybe they do or they don't have clinical thyroiditis to go with that. What do you say to them to address that biomarker that's, you know, standing out and that they're holding on to?
Well, I think that you need some sitting with a patient and have a conversation with them about the problems in interpreting or considering that just because they have this antibody, it doesn't really mean that they have a specific disease. Perhaps yes, perhaps no. But this happens in autoimmune neurology, this happens in other examples. So what happens with a patient that comes and has symptoms that have nothing to do with, for example, the LGI1 or Caspar-2 antibodies, but they firmly believe that they have voltage-gated potassium channel antibodies and you don't know the link between them. So it's a little bit in all these disorders that are not well-defined or that the biomarker is not very clear or becomes clear that is really confusing biomarker, I think that you need to re-educate a little bit the patient, which is extremely difficult sometimes because some of these patients actually have very chronic symptoms. They have been treated with steroids, so in some way they become an anti-concept of Hashimoto encephalopathy. It's actually totally opposite of what the classical idea is, but some of these patients have been considered, diagnosed, treated for even sometimes several years, and we don't know the disease. And it's very difficult to reverse this in a patient, and many times one isn't successful. But this is what I do.
Right. You know, it's important, and perhaps why we do this podcast is let's come to a consensus as a community of doctors first and then hopefully prevent it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Frances, another question for you. If we're talking specifically about the study, you looked at symptoms and steroid responsiveness in 24 patients who met the existing criteria of Hashimoto encephalopathy, and you compared those 24 patients to several other controls, 74 patients with criteria of possible autoimmune encephalitis without neuronal antibodies, and another 205 patients with different neuroimmunologic diseases, psychosis, or even new onset refractory status epilepticus, which we know as NORS. So what did you find?
The main objective of our study was to know the frequency of response to steroids in a group of patients who fulfill all the pretreatment criteria for Hashimoto encephalopathy. So these were patients that in theory they should have to respond. But at the end of the study, only 30% of the patients made a complete or almost complete response to corticosteroid treatment. These patients were otherwise similar to those who did not respond to corticosteroids, and therefore it was impossible to distinguish them before treatment, suggesting that the criteria probably are not good predictors to treatment response, and perhaps these criteria somehow should be modified. A second objective of the study was to confirm what it was suspected in the literature, that there is a pure specificity of TPO antibodies to pinpoint the diagnosis of Hashimoto encephalopathy. In fact, in our study, we found that the frequency of TPO antibodies was around 8% in patients in whom the neurologist who referred the sample to us initially suspected the diagnosis of Hashimoto encephalopathy. But more important was the fact that this frequency of 8% was similar to that of a group of patients with encephalitis and other neurological syndromes associated with well-characterized antibodies such as NMDR or aquaporin-4. This data, in our opinion, indicate that the TPO antibodies cannot be used to identify the clinical entity that may or may not respond to corticosteroid treatment. In addition to that, recently some investigators have suggested that antibodies against the amino-terminal of alpha enolase could be good specific biomarkers of at least a subset of patients with Hashimoto encephalopathy who present with radiological features of limbic encephalitis. We search for these antibodies following the same methodology that had been published in the past, but unfortunately we failed to confirm the results that had been reported. And in our hands, the antibodies against the amino terminal or of alpha-enolase were really not very useful. So again, we were unable to confirm any possible biomarker that could be helpful in the diagnosis of Hashimoto encephalopathy.
There's really a lot in what you just said. So a couple of things. One, the TPO antibodies don't help. Two, the other proposed biomarker, this alpha-enolase terminal, is also not a good biomarker. It was proposed, but you were unable to find evidence.
Yeah, in our hands, it didn't work.
Right. And then, you know, something else that's important in there earlier in what you said was even when physicians are making the diagnosis of Hashimoto's encephalopathy, we're not even following the existing criteria, right?
Right. I think that in general, these criteria that on the first one say the patient must have encephalopathy or psychiatric problems or neurological symptoms, I mean, they forget about the concept of encephalopathy. And if the patient has a psychiatric problem, so far the TPO antibodies are positive and there is no other explanation. Neurology sometimes, they say, well, this is a Hashimoto encephalopathy and start treating the patient. That is potentially dangerous for the patient. So I think that the liberal use of the criteria has increased a lot of confusion in this area.
Absolutely. Josep, what else do we need to know as neurologists to make sure we're taking the best possible care of these patients, whether we see them in referral or whether these TPO antibodies come up in the course of our clinical evaluations for patients with suspected encephalopathy or similar symptoms?
Well, I think that most of the things have already been discussed, not much else to discuss, just only some considerations. Perhaps keep in mind that we don't know how many patients previously diagnosed with Hashimoto encephalopathy had other diseases, such as any of the many autoimmune encephalitis, or even some of the MOC antibody-associated syndromes, which not always associated with demyelination, but all these syndromes respond to immunotherapy. And finally, just keep in mind that the diagnosis of Hashimoto encephalopathy is not an easy one, just of CNS symptoms and presence of TPO. Actually, it's becoming more complicated because it's a diagnosis of exclusion of many other disorders. So I think that with these updated criteria and keeping in mind what it's coming up with our study and other studies, so the diagnosis becomes a little bit more laborious because you have to exclude all these other disorders.
So really a word of caution before considering and applying this diagnostic label is good.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Josep and Frances, for taking the time to discuss the controversial entity of Hashimoto's encephalopathy and really outlining a way forward to be sure that patients where this diagnosis is being considered receive ideal diagnostics and ultimately treatment and hopefully have the best outcomes. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much from both of us.
Hello, I'm Dr. Tisha Monteith from the University of Miami. Today we're going to discuss a new paper recently published in Neurology called Migraine Progression in Subgroups of Migraine Based on Comorbidities, Results of the CAMEO Study. With us today to discuss is Dr. Richard Lipton, Professor of Neurology and Director of the Montefiore Headache Center, and Dr. Don Buse, Clinical Professor of Neurology and Board Member at Large of the American Headache Society at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. We're grateful to have them on today to discuss the findings of the Chronic Migraine Epidemiology and Outcome Study, known as CAMEO, a web-based investigation designed to assess migraine characteristics, treatment, impact, family burden, barriers to medical care, and comorbidities. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tessa. Happy to be here.
So, how long have you guys been working together?
Almost 14 years, and it's been a really amazing partnership, mentorship, and friendship. I love working with Richard.
And how many papers have come out of that?
Well, we've written north of 100 papers together. I know that. So we've been very productive and had a very good time together.
So before we talk about the main findings of your paper, will you explain quickly why the study was done?
Sure. So we've known for a long time that migraine has a number of comorbidities, meaning conditions that are associated with migraine with greater than chance frequency. So we've known that respiratory diseases, depression, anxiety, pain problems all occur in people with migraine more commonly than they would by chance alone. And in a previous study, we used a technique called latent class analysis to see if comorbidities clustered together. And our idea was that if comorbidities occurred together, such as depression and anxiety, which obviously occur together, that we might be able to identify biologically homogeneous groups of migraine based on comorbidity profiles. In this paper, our goal was to take groups of patients with migraine defined based on their comorbidity profiles and evaluate them over a year of follow-up to see if the comorbidity profiles predicted the risk of making the transition from episodic migraine with less than 15 days a month to chronic migraine with 15 or more days a month of headache.
And Tesha, I wanted to let you know this manuscript is actually more than a decade in the making. I remember sitting with Richard. I remember where we were sitting. I can picture the room when he was talking about this idea about 11 or 12 years ago of endophenotypes and natural clusters and would they predict outcomes. And, you know, at the rate research goes, you know, it took that long to design the study and collect the data and analyze the data. So it's really exciting to actually see these results. And thinking back to that first conversation where we talked about these ideas has been a great journey.
It seems like the best research is a great journey. So what were the major findings of the paper, and how is it of clinical value to the practicing neurologists? Because we all see a lot of migraine.
So the major findings were that a number of different comorbidity groups were at increased risk of making the transition from episodic to chronic migraine. So there was one group we called the most comorbidity group, and in that group, the respiratory, psychiatric, and pain comorbidities all occurred with greater frequency than might be expected, and that group was 5 times more likely to make the transition from episodic migraine to chronic migraine. And then we found in other groups, those with respiratory comorbidities like asthma and rhinitis, those with pain comorbidities like osteoarthritis and fibromyalgia were all more likely to worsen over time as we followed people longitudinally in the study.
In addition, we know that many of these conditions are best treated with a multidisciplinary approach, and those may be conditions such as anxiety and depression, obesity, pain, and sleep. And for all those conditions, it's nice to have colleagues who can help with the management, which may include other physicians, may include psychologists, it may include PT, OT, nutritionists, and a whole range of people who can really help patients from a variety of knowledge bases and modalities.
That's really interesting. Were the subjects recruited in the study similar to what we would see in clinic?
Well, so this was a web survey. So what we did was identify a panel of U.S. citizens selected to be demographically representative of the U.S. population. We emailed a validated questionnaire to identify people with migraine. And in that sense, the sample is much more representative of people with migraine in general than it is of people with migraine who may come to a neurologist's office or a headache specialist office.
Which subgroups represent the greatest predictors of progression to chronic migraine?
So we found that the group with the most comorbidities had the greatest risk of progression, but a group that had respiratory and psychiatric comorbidities, respiratory and pain comorbidities, and just psychiatric comorbidities were also at increased risk. I think our next task is to figure out how this can inform mechanisms and also how we can use it therapeutically.
And what about with medication overuse?
So medication overuse, particularly overuse of opioid and barbiturate-containing analgesic products, predicts the development of chronic migraine in people with episodic migraine.
I'm going to ask this question to both of you. How should the treating neurologist approach patients with migraine and various comorbidities so that we limit the potential for progression to chronic migraine? Do we know enough yet?
Well, In general practice, it's best practice to assess, treat, and or refer for the treatment of comorbidities. And some are quite common in migraine, as Tessa, you and Richard and all of the neurologists listening to this podcast know. Some are so common that neurologists may already have screeners on hand in their offices. They may already have referrals lined up, and that may be, for example, depression or anxiety, perhaps cardiac conditions, respiratory conditions. And there are some conditions that neurologists may feel comfortable managing on their own, whereas others may be best with co-management, perhaps with a cardiologist, a psychologist, an allergist. In fact, many of these conditions are known to be best treated with a multidisciplinary approach, such as anxiety, depression, pain, sleep, or obesity. And I also think that having a team approach, or at least a referring source, also takes some of the burden off the individual neurologist. It's nice to have a team to work with and get different types of expertise and perspectives on treating a patient. So, you know, Richard and I have worked together for over a decade, and it's very helpful to get both of our perspectives together and both of our different approaches to therapies together to really treat comorbidities. Now, we don't know yet if treating these comorbidities would reduce the rates of progression. That would be a really large study, which we'd like to do, but we don't have those data exactly. But we do know the opposite. We do know many things. We know that these diseases tend to coexist with many negative outcomes, like worse treatment adherence, worse disability, worse quality of life. And we do know that successful migraine management tends to reduce the experience, whether it's severity or at all, of many of these conditions like depression and anxiety. You know, that may or may not be the case with some of the other conditions, such as cardiac conditions or respiratory conditions. But in general, we do know that assessing and either treating or referring for treatment is good practice. It helps take the burden off the single neurologist provider by having a team or a colleague to work with, and usually we'll get to improved outcomes that improve all around quality of life for the patient.
Yes, I would add that, you know, we traditionally have defined the goals of acute treatment as relieving pain and restoring function, and the goals of preventive treatment as reducing monthly migraine days or attack frequency and global disability. Data showing that many remediable risk factors are associated with an increased risk of progression creates a window into a new treatment paradigm. And that paradigm is identifying people with episodic migraine who may be at high risk for progressing and endeavoring to intervene early to keep the condition from worsening. Because we know that people with chronic migraine obviously have more headaches, suffer more, have more disability, miss more work, are sometimes underemployed or unemployed, and use more healthcare resources.
Excellent. We've been speaking with Drs. Richard Lipton and Don Boos about the recent publication, Migraine Progression in Subgroups of Migraine Based on Comorbidities, results of the CAMEO study. Based on their phenomenal work, it appears that migraine comorbidities do matter, and it seems to be independent of migraine severity and disability. A few open questions include factors associated with remission from chronic migraine back to episodic migraine and the influence of treatments. I look forward to reading more about the CAMEO study and invite you to review this excellent paper in neurology. Thank you.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on prion disease incidence in the U.S. from 2003 to 2015, and another article on acute ischemic stroke in adolescents. Please take a look at these and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.